A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
You are just number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 60. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of 1984. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. So yes, as you say, Brian, we're continuing to discuss a BBC adaptation of George Orwell's 1984 that was broadcast in 1954 and was adapted for the television by our very favourite writer here on British Invaders, Nigel Neal. And as we discussed in the last episode, he worked with Rudolf Cartier to produce a very faithful adaptation of Orwell's novel.
So now let's talk a little bit more about the story. We sort of touched on it last time, but let's get into that a little bit more. So we really center on Winston Smith, who is an outer party member. He's sort of an everyman, and he is the hero of the piece. And he begins to doubt the party line. And actually, as the piece starts, we see that he is not convinced. He isn't swallowing what they're telling him. He knows that there is something wrong with the party, with Big Brother, and with all of this world. And we see that his work is essentially revising history, altering the truth. So basically, whenever something in the past has been predicted and the prediction is wrong, Winston Smith will get a message that said there was an error in this newspaper. Big Brother said that this was supposed to happen and it didn't actually happen, so it must have been an error in the newspaper. He kind of actually said something that didn't turn out to be true. So they changed the newspaper from sometime in the past so it says what they wanted to say. So it works out that he made a prediction that we now know comes true. And this is how Winston spends his time, how he earns his living. And he is supposed to believe that he is actually just fixing the errors. He knows he's not just fixing errors.
That's right. And I think it's that that knowledge which gives him, I suppose, the insight into the fact that the party line may not be all it's cracked up to be. And he has his doubts and he questions things right from very early on. And, I mean, part of it, we do hear him, his thoughts at times, because we get to hear him committing what he regards as thought crime and thinking illegal thoughts about the party and about Big Brother and how he hates Big Brother. And then we also get the story of his attraction to Julia, the other character we mentioned, who at first seems to be repelled by him, and she's a member of something called the Anti-Sex League. Because as you mentioned in the last episode, Brian, even sex is controlled in this society. So at first she seems uninterested in him, but as we learn, she's actually concealing some truths as well. And so Winston and Julia are sort of set on a doomed and certainly illegal relationship.
And we get this contrast of the two of them who are both disenchanted with the party and both do not believe in Big Brother and in all of these arbitrary rules and all of these strange things. They both want to do other things. They want to be free. But the two characters do that in very different ways. So Winston Smith is very troubled as a character, and he wants to change the world. He wants to escape somehow. He is bothered about what happens in the world, what happens to others, and he has a great deal of difficulty with this. He's very troubled by it. Where Julia is much more accepting and feels much more that this is just how the world is and there isn't anything she can do about it, and she doesn't know what's true and what isn't, but it doesn't necessarily matter, and she just wants to take the time she has and spend it the best way she can, get the most out of her life.
Yeah, she has a much more, we learn that she actually has a much more free attitude towards their rebellion. Or as you say, Winston is troubled by his doubts and his guilt along the way.
And what it leads Winston to do is to make contact, or attempt to make contact, and eventually make some kind of contact with the sort of enemy group, the group that opposes the party, which is known as the Brotherhood, and is prominently decried as a group of criminals by the party literature and the messages from the telescreens.
And of course, his contact in this organization, this underground organization that opposes the party, may lead him into even further trouble. It's tricky to discuss this because I suspect that most people know the story of 1984 and how this is going to come out for Winston and Julia. But we get some clues along the way that their destiny may lie in something called Room 101, which is very mysterious and certainly very feared by people who mention it.
Yes, even for 1984, we want to avoid spoilers a little bit, just for the odd person who hasn't read the book yet, because it is such a great book and you should read it without being entirely spoiled if possible.
Absolutely. So we won't go into too many details, but we can tell that perhaps, you know, the future's not necessarily bright for Winston and Julia.
Yes, we have a type of downward spiral for these characters, and what happens along the way and where that goes is much of what makes this such a remarkable piece of literature, and also what makes this adaptation so successful.
So this adaptation went out on December the 12th, 1954, 1 hour and 50 minutes. A very big production for the BBC, as we discussed in the last episode. Quite a massive production, mostly live. And I think it's fair to say, Brian, that it caused an uproar.
Yes.
It certainly provoked a response, didn't it? And in particular, some sequences that showed basically characters being tortured and something of what went on in Room 101 were thought to be very controversial. And they were denounced in the British press. There were questions asked in the British Parliament. There were reports in one newspaper that a woman had actually died of fright while watching the film 1984.
That sounds quite bizarre. I wonder where that report actually came from.
And how much truth there was in that. But certainly, I mean, in the press, there was all sorts of fuss about it.
Yes. And we already talked about the War Game, which was a decade later and had questions asked about it in Parliament. Well, much earlier in 54, MPs tabled early day motions in Parliament attacking the BBC, and other MPs tabled amendments defending the BBC. So there was a debate of a sort that went on over this in Parliament about doing such an extreme type of show and something as involved and as disturbing as 1984 in some respects is.
Absolutely. You know, questions as to whether the BBC should have done it at all.
That's right. And questions about that planned second performance.
And whether it should go ahead.
Exactly. Well, Michael Barry, the head of BBC Drama, was summoned to defend the film on the news program Panorama, and the BBC said, okay, we're doing this, we put all this into it, we're going ahead with the second performance on Thursday, December 16th.
But as you say, that was a controversial decision at the time, and those 3 or 4 days in December 54 must have been, you know, quite frenzied with all this stuff going on in the press. The head of drama being summoned to defend it on the news programmes, and even the MPs in Parliament debating this film. And then, as there's some doubt as to whether the second performance will go ahead, we get this fantastic story, one of those great stories that attaches to Nigel Neill's work on television in the 1950s. The other great story, which you and Zander mentioned, was that when Quatermass was shown, the streets and the pubs and the cinemas would be empty.
Yes.
That's right. Everybody was at home watching Quatermass.
For Quatermass in the pit, yeah.
Yeah. And then we get this other great story that Prince Philip was apparently that week speaking at a film institute, giving a lecture about film and television. And during this talk, he mentioned that he and the Queen had watched the first broadcast of 1984 and had enjoyed it. And at which point, there seems to have been a reverse of popular opinion about the film, Brian.
That's quite bizarre. But I guess these things can happen sometimes.
I mean, the way Nigel Neal tells it, or he told it before his death, sadly, the way I've seen him tell it was that once people heard that the Queen and Prince Philip had enjoyed the television show, certain newspapers who'd run critical reviews immediately then brought out very positive reviews of the same film, but written by different reviewers. So the royal influence obviously had an effect.
This was at a time when television was quite new. So the idea of having something that many people across the country could watch simultaneously and, you know, these newspaper reviews from all over the country and all of these types of things, that was something that was quite new. And I think at that time, television was still sort of changing in culture. You know, it was still something that it wasn't quite certain what people would make of it in certain situations.
You're hard at work on the dictionary, I suppose?
Yes, I've reached the adjectives at last. It's fascinating working in the research department. We're in constant touch with our colleagues in New York, getting the language into its final shape. New speak.
I can see we'll have a busy time. It becomes compulsory, learning all the new words your department's invented for us.
We're not only inventing words, we're destroying them. Scores of them, thousands every day. It's beautiful.
Beautiful?
With simplicity out, of course. Oh, for one example, just take the word good. If you have that, what need for the word bad? Ungood does just as well. Then instead of a string of vague extra words like excellent and splendid, you have plus good, or stronger still, double plus good. In Newspeak, the whole notion of goodness and badness will be covered by six words. In reality, by only one word. Don't you see the beauty of that, Winston? It was B.B.'s idea originally, of course.
I do my best to keep up with the published changes.
Do you? Mm. Yes, I've read some of those little pieces you've had published in the Times occasionally.
In Newspeak, too?
Good in their way, but only translations. You are still thinking in old speak, clinging to useless shades of meaning.
To be or not to be.
The verb to be is abolished in the 11th edition. That is the question.
So the second broadcast did go ahead. It was tele-recorded onto 35mm film. It had 7 million viewers, which was the largest audience since the coronation of the Queen, which was broadcast the previous year. So 7 million doesn't seem huge now, but at the time, not all that many people had TVs. So this was a very big event by this time that the second performance was broadcast.
Goodness knows how many televisions there were in 1954, but I mean, that must have been a huge audience at the time. And everybody was talking about this television. Everybody was talking about Rudolf Cartier and Nigel Neal's production. They'd done it again, as they'd done with Quatermass.
That's right. And I think, as we had mentioned in the previous episode, I think in 54, 1984 as a book was not as well known as it is now. It was not something where everyone would know, okay, this is Orwell, this is 1984, this is the type of thing that we're expecting to see. So people were taken aback by this, and this is why you had all of this controversy, and, you know, people didn't know what to make of it. It was something very new and very different.
Absolutely, yes. Just to imagine what effect it must have had for people who didn't know the story and to watch this. Now, we did mention that we were going to discuss some other versions of 1984. 2 years later, Hollywood produced its own film version, which starred Edmund O'Brien as Winston Smith. And interestingly, had Donald Pleasance in it again. He cropped up in a very similar role to the part of Sign that he played in this adaptation.
I think he actually played Parsons, but it was like a composite version of Simon Parsons because they didn't have them both in that particular film.
I think that's right, yes.
And the BBC actually reused Nigel Neal's script in 1965. So it was not a live performance, but they did a new production with David Buck and Joseph O'Connor, Jane Merrill, and Cyril Shapps, which would have been an interesting one, certainly with Cyril Shapps in there. Unfortunately, that production does not survive. It was lost by the BBC. But interesting idea.
Yes, reusing the script again.
And also in 1965, BBC Radio had an adaptation, and that was featuring Patrick Troughton, who, of course, we know very well from being the second Doctor on Doctor Who from the 1960s. But Troughton was also a wonderful character actor who played many widely varied roles, so that also would have been an interesting one to hear.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, it would be fantastic to be able to hear Patrick Troughton on the radio doing it. Then in 1984 itself, of course, we had a very famous film adaptation, the second version from the big screen, with John Hurt playing Winston Smith and Richard Burton famously playing O'Brien. Quite a big budget production, and of course brought out in the year of the title.
Yes, definitely a little bit modernized compared to the previous ones, I think. And interestingly enough, in 2005, there was actually an opera written by Lauren Mazel with a libretto by J.D. McClatchy and Thomas Meehan. I hope I'm pronouncing those correctly. But yeah, this 2005 opera was premiered in the UK, which I don't know a great deal about, but also interesting idea for a take on it.
Okay. And then, of course, the book itself has gone on to influence countless other works of literature. So we've had books influenced by 1984. We've had comics influenced by it. We've had TV shows, other films, commercials, everything, music, all inspired by the themes that Orwell explored in this hugely important piece of literature from the last century.
The word Orwellian is a word for a reason, because the ideas in 1984 and also the earlier ideas from Animal Farm are so common and have been used in so many places and been an influence to so many different things.
It just, as we said in the last episode, it crops up everywhere. It's become part of our modern culture, an idiom to just, you know, refer to Orwell and his ideas all the time.
So I think it's time that we get into some of our reactions and our feelings about some of the things they did in this drama of 1984. So, Eamon, what do you think were some of the highlights of this 1954 version of 1984?
Well, we sort of touched on it already, Brian, but we'll get into them now, which is the performances of the actors. I mean, as we mentioned before, we've got big actors here who would go on to be much more famous after this. So here we catch them very early on in their careers. And the performances are really, they're just all-round terrific, aren't they, Brian?
Yes, they are very solid.
I mean, Peter Cushing, and particularly I think the scenes between Peter Cushing as Winston Smith and André Morel as O'Brien are fantastic. And then they're ably supported by Donald Pleasance, by Yvonne Mitchell, but also by the whole cast, really.
Yes, this actually changed my opinion of some of these actors, particularly Peter Cushing. I knew that he had done some good stuff, and, you know, he's done Sherlock Holmes and all of these horror films and different things, but I was very impressed when I saw his performance in this. And likewise, André Morel was really fantastic in this.
Yes, he's outstanding. I mean, he's terrific as Quatermass, but he's absolutely awesome to watch him in this performance. And as you say, Peter Cushing, I mean, we're used to Peter Cushing playing very sort of powerful, decisive characters, you know, Van Helsing and Sherlock Holmes and Moff Tarkin. And yet here we see him playing a very sort of, conflicted and at times weak and unsure character. And then his performance in the sequences in Room 101 are just, it's terrifying. Remarkable stuff.
Yes, a lot of what works well in this, and it does work very well, a lot of what works well in this is related to the performances by a number of those actors. And I would certainly include Donald Pleasence in that as well.
Yeah, he gets one very important scene.
Yes, he has a couple of scenes that are very good, for sure. I would also say that another thing that is very strong in this is Nigel Neal's script. He stayed quite close to the novel, but at the same time kept the pace going quite well, and he kept the themes of it always in the foreground. So all of these ideas about this world, this situation, what's happening to these people, the idea of the surveillance and the revisionist history and the rationing and the restrictions and all of these things, these were always very clear. The threat, the idea that these things were scary to the characters, those never went away. You know, it was focused well on those things, and it really kept things running very well from end to end. So that was really done well.
So we love a Nigel Neal script here on British Invaders. What about the look of this production, Brian? What about the filming and the camera work and sets?
Well, of course, as we look at it now, it's very dated. And the copy of it that survives is not a very high-quality copy. What people would have seen broadcast in 54 would have looked much better. But it does have a fairly distinctive look. It's very dated. I think a lot of this comes down to, what do you feel about old 1950s style live productions? If you enjoy that at all, well, this was a good example of it. It was done well.
Yeah, there is. It is very interesting. As you say, it is clearly, it's, you know, obviously this is a black and white production, but it looks austere, and it looks, we see London in ruins. It's very interesting. And I think Cartier also did some interesting things with the camera work. Particularly moments when characters look straight into the camera, particularly Winston Smith, that he looks into the camera and we hear his thoughts, which I think was quite interesting for television in that at that time.
Yes, the voiceover of his thoughts, while we've seen it done in many other things now, I think it was probably fairly unusual at the time. And it was very effective. I would say more effective than almost any other production that I've seen using that.
Attention, comrades, attention! Here is a supplementary production bulletin issued by the Ministry of Plenty, giving further glorious news of the success of the 7th 3-year plan. A clear demonstration of the rising standard of our new happy life, the latest calculated increases are as follows. Domestic utility furniture, 97%. Electric light fittings, 60%. Domestic glassware, 129.
So are there any moments that don't work quite so well, apart from the slightly reduced quality film that we get to watch now?
Well, for me, I would say there's very little. You have some of the sets are sort of obviously look like sets and look sort of flimsy when people open and close doors and things like that. And I mentioned, you know, sort of the video quality, you know, you have to excuse some of those kinds of things. Apart from that, apart from those types of things, and apart from it being generally dated, because this is, you know, well over 50 years ago that this was made, apart from that, there is very little I can find flaws with. There are a couple points that some of the actors hesitate a little bit and seem to struggle with their lines a little bit, but they're few and far between. There are only a couple of them.
Absolutely. For a live performance, there's very few of them, isn't there? And even the sets, the slightly wobbly sets, almost seem to work, because we know that the people in the film are supposed to be living in very cramped surroundings, and that flats have been divided and subdivided several times. So it almost seems to go along with that sort of setting, really, doesn't it?
That's true. It does help to add to this sort of very powerful gray sort of looking context that they give you.
So our favorite moments from the performance, from the production?
Oh, interesting question. There are a couple of them for me. One is going to be some of the interrogation type stuff, not room 101, although that was very good, but leading up to that, there was some remarkable stuff that was there. And also a couple of the moments with Donald Pleasance as Syme is breaking down and struggling with what's happening.
Yes, that is very good. But as you say, the moments between Winston Smith and O'Brien and then going on to the interrogation scenes are just fantastic. And very sort of uncompromising and unflinching. You know, it doesn't pull any punches for this 1954 television production.
Yes, you would wonder for that time, are they going to go all of the places where the book goes? And basically they did.
They do, yeah.
They didn't cover absolutely everything from the book, as, you know, this is an adaptation. But it was pretty close. They included almost all the ideas and most of the scenes and sequences of things that were sort of key to the ideas and to the characters. They were basically there. That is pretty impressive for that time. And they were able to maintain the intensity and also the chemistry between the characters pretty well throughout.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, they kept it up for this hour and 50 minutes of what must have been quite frantic production with them all running around behind these 17 sets.
Absolutely. So going from that into our recommendations, I think it's not too hard to think what we're going to say, Eamon.
Well, I think, as you say, Brian, we've given this one away as we go along. For me, 1984, this production by Rudolf Cartier and Nigel Neal from the BBC is absolutely fantastic. And I wouldn't have watched it if it hadn't been for British Invaders. I wouldn't have known that it existed if it hadn't been for British Invaders. So it's just, I really, really like it. Imagine you are in post-war austerity Britain, staring at the small black and white television screen and watch this film, because it is just outstanding. Brian.
Absolutely. I basically agree with that. What I'll say, if you have not read the book 1984, go and read it. You should read that. And if you are able to watch old black and white TV at all, then watch this adaptation of 1984. It is well worth watching. And if you're not able to watch old black and white TV, maybe it's time to learn.
Yes. You should learn for this, because it is really worth it, and it's a famous moment in British television history.
Absolutely. It's definitely a classic. So availability.
Yes, if you do want to watch it after hearing us talk about it, and we hope that you do, how can you get to watch it? Well, it's never been released on DVD or VHS, although it has been rebroadcast by the BBC over the years, on three occasions, I believe, 77, 1994, and most recently in 2003, all of them obviously showing the tele-recording of the second performance, which we've been talking about.
That's right. Now, archive.org has made this available for posterity, and we will have a link to that in the show notes, but there is this copy that's available online that you can download that is made available because there is very little in the way of ways to get a hold of it otherwise. We are hoping that there will be a DVD release, and I would certainly be lining up to buy that. But it is available on archive.org, and we put a link to that on our Facebook page, and we'll put one in the show notes for this episode as well.
And it's that's where we downloaded it from and watched it for our discussion. Although you can also watch it on YouTube as well. It's up on YouTube. If you search for 1984 and Nigel Neal, you'll find it. I think it's in several parts. It's in, I think, 8 or 9 or 10 parts up there, but you can find it on YouTube and watch it there.
It is a little awkward to watch it in the parts. The viewing online or download from archive.org is a little more convenient.
Yes, and certainly when I downloaded it, you don't get that slight voice syncing problem that you sometimes get on YouTube.
So, in summary, 1984 was a classic George Orwell novel published in 1949 and adapted by Nigel Neal and Rudolf Cartier to the screen in 1954 for a live production. It was about a world where everything is caught on surveillance, and Big Brother and the inner party control everything that people can have and what people are allowed to do, and history is constantly revised to make the party and the inner party and Big Brother look better and look like they are always correct in everything that they've said. And specifically, it follows Winston Smith and Julia and others who have become disenchanted with Big Brother and the party and this way of doing things, and try to look for another way and do other things. And we see where it leads them in this classic piece of literature and classic piece of British television.
Absolutely. It's fantastic. Please do watch it, and then please do tell us what you thought about it.
And BBC, please put it out on DVD.
Absolutely. So next time on British Invaders, we're going to come slightly more up to date. We're going back to 1993 for a BBC children's serial called Century Falls, which was an early work by somebody who would go on to be quite important in British science fiction, Brian.
Yes, that's Russell T Davies.
Who would become, or has become, the showrunner of the new Doctor Who.
Yes, brought Doctor Who back to our screens in 2005. Century Falls is a nice sort of spooky production, so that'll be interesting to talk about. And it's also from a time period where there was not a lot of British science fiction TV being produced in the early 90s. So that'll be interesting too.
Okay.
You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there.
And please do come along to Facebook and get the link for 1984 and let us know what you think.
Absolutely, and we'll have the link on our show notes too. So thank you for listening. And this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Thank you very much indeed. This is Eamon from England, saying goodbye.